directly from the thrombin and the ischemic heart disease transition to heart failure, and hear Lloyd Haskell's comment here, and try to. We want to have some time. We need to end on time, so try to be brief to the point.
If we go back to the previous slide deck again, we're going to move up a little bit in the cascade. I have a disclosure. I work for Johnson & Johnson, and we, with our partners Bayer, developed rivaroxaban for a number of indications. I also want to acknowledge Dr. Georgiotti and Professor Zanard, who we've been discussing at heart failure trial with anti-10A for longer than I want to admit. But we've been discussing it for about 6 years. We've been through multiple iterations on how to do the heart failure trial. We can move on. And we've worked together so much about it that we actually shared a lot of slides in common, and I won't show them. So let's move on. I have some new data that Dr. Zanard asked for, which I think will be very useful for the audience to see. I just want to preface it, and you've seen this already, but unquestionably heart failure is a hypercoagulable state, very much so. And if you look at the second bullet here with the thromboembolic events are clinically silent, I don't think they're silent. I think nobody looks for them. And I think that's what the problem is. I think it's there all the time. And I just have to say, in 2005, I was thumbing through the 3-inch thick AHA abstract book, and I found an abstract from a group of physicians in Russia. And this wasn't accepted for either a poster or an oral presentation, but they autopsied heart failure patients, and 45% of them had highly significant pulmonary emboli on autopsy. This is not new, but it was good to see that it was seen again. And because I was so impressed with this, that we actually patented the idea, the use of anti-10A in heart failure based on that report. And my opinion initially was that if we could prevent, I think there's a lot of unrecognized VTE and a lot of unrecognized PE, and I think that makes a lot of people worse with heart failure. But again, when they come in with shortness of breath, you know, everybody treats them for heart failure. Nobody even thinks about PE at the time. But I really believe it's there. And really something, if you can control that, would be a big help for heart failure patients. So let me just, we know all this already, it's highly, let me get to some actual data. Just let me say one thing about the WASH study. It was brought up by Dr. Zanard, but I just want to point out that this study was very important in that it really spurred the argument of whether aspirin is bad for patients with heart failure. And this comes into something that that Dr. Zanard mentioned about using aspirin. There are a lot of physicians who treat heart failure who believe aspirin is detrimental. And we discussed this with regulatory agencies, and they really want to see a high percentage of patients on aspirin in a heart failure trial. But that might be difficult given the fact that some physicians really are loath to use aspirin. So that's a consideration that has to be taken in mind if and when a heart failure trial is done. You heard about all these. One thing we learned about WASH, WATCH, and WASEF is that warfarin decreases the rate of stroke. There's a very high incidence of stroke in patients with heart failure. There were signals in all the studies that if it does anything, anticoagulation reduces the incidence of stroke. There are also signals to show that there was less hospitalization, be it all cause or be it for heart failure hospitalization with anticoagulation compared to controls. So there are signals here, but as we heard from Dr. Zanard, none of this is we could draw any strong conclusions. And just let me go now. This is actual data. We did a phase one trial in severe heart failure patients with rivaroxaban. And what I want to point out here are two things. Number one, patients with heart failure handle rivaroxaban pretty well. They don't their levels really are not sky high. It's really the elevated levels are probably more related to their renal function than to their underlying heart failure. And the second thing, as far as dynamics are concerned, if you look here at the markers for hypercoagulability or turned on coagulation, if you can see fragment F1-2 was actually reduced by rivaroxaban treatment, and that was statistically significant. So there's a clue here that the hypercoagulable state can be modified by the use of an anti-10A in these patients. Similarly, D-dimer really elevated over the week in the control patients, but really stayed the same in patients who were treated with rivaroxaban. And there was also a slight decrease over the thrombin, antithrombin complexes. So you can see the heart failure. In heart failure, the systems are turned on, and rivaroxaban clearly has an effect on altering the hypercoagulability. Now, here's the new data that was just presented at this year's AHA, so I can present them here. And this is the ROCKET study. The ROCKET study, as we all heard, had about 15,000 patients. Two-thirds of them had heart failure. So what I'm going to present to you today are the heart failure cohort from the ROCKET study. And this really adds to the notion that anticoagulation are good or safe and tolerated fairly well in patients with heart failure. That's always been a concern in heart failure, is bleeding and how they do. But I can tell you that we've done a number of studies, obviously, with rivaroxaban. We've always looked at the heart failure cohorts. The heart failure cohorts do not do any worse. Their bleeding is not any worse than the others, and this is almost uniform. We have an experience in ACS, which has not been published yet, so I can't, I don't have the final results, so we can't share what happens in the heart failure cohort in ACS, but here in AFib, you'll be seeing it now. And this is the main results of the trial, which we won't dwell on, and this is everybody. Rivaroxaban was, you can see the results here, and the primary endpoint here was stroke and non-CNS embolization. Rivaroxaban is as good as warfarin. The bleeding, as you heard earlier, is somewhat better. So what we did, we defined heart failure as anybody who had a left ventricular ejection fraction less than 40, or if the investigator checked that they had a history of heart failure. And as I said, this was about two-thirds of the total population. This was a high-risk population than RELY, for example, where there was only about, if I recall directly as I'm jet-lagged, about 25% had heart failure. We had about 63% heart failure in our trial. And if you're interested in time and therapeutic range, it really was better in patients with heart failure on warfarin it was not that much different. It was always also a concern that heart failure patients do poorly on warfarin. It's harder to control. And as you can see here, that, you know, to a slightly higher control on patients without heart failure. But these are the ends, and you can see we had almost twice as many patients with heart failure than without heart failure in the ROCKET trial. I'll skip this slide. The baseline, one thing I want to point out here. The patients with heart failure baseline, they were younger, but they also had higher incidence of hypertension, higher incidence of diabetes. And you can see here the medication they were on. It's expected what you might see in heart failure. There wasn't a very high use of ACE inhibitors and diuretics, as you might expect in a pure heart failure trial, because we didn't really differentiate what class they were in and how severe the heart failure was. So here are the results. And if you look at the heart failure population, the incidence of stroke or systemic embolization was 1.99 in the heart failure population as compared to 2.32 in the non-heart failure population. And what I do want to point out, as you might expect, the all-cause mortality was higher in the heart failure population, vascular death was higher, and myocardial infarction was higher. And this is just probably a reflection of the higher risk, the underlying risks in these patients. And here's the bleeding. The bleeding was actually slightly less in the heart failure group. The hemorrhagic stroke of interest, an intracranial hemorrhage, was significantly less, significantly from a clinical perspective. So that's something important to recognize. So in heart failure, again, the incident, when looking at rivaroxaban compared to warfarin, they had less intracranial hemorrhage in the heart failure group than in the non-heart failure group. So again, for time, I'm not going to go through all the slides, but we looked at various different iterations of the results. So here's a summary of the total results of the heart failure cohort in ROCKET. And you can see in the red are the warfarin groups. No heart failure on warfarin did the worst. Heart failure on warfarin was the next red line. And then the two rivaroxaban slides groups are seen in the blue. And the heart failure on rivaroxaban, although we can't make any conclusions, you know, it's the bottom line on this, on the Kaplan-Meier curve. So if anything, they don't do worse. It looks like they do a little bit better, but clearly when it comes to intracranial hemorrhage, they do better. So again, for the time, I'll end here. If you have any questions, I can answer them. But just in summary, in my opinion, there's no doubt that heart failure patients would benefit from anticoagulation for a number of reasons. We mentioned, you know, PE and DVT are there. Also MI, I think silent MI is an issue in heart failure patients where we might get benefit from the use of rivaroxaban. And unfortunately, once we can't see the results from our ACS trials, but I'm sure they'll be available soon, and that will really strengthen the argument that heart failure patients would benefit from an anti-10A inhibition. Thank you. I'll end my talk now.
Thank you very much.